From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. More than 30 sharks were tagged along Florida's Gulf Coast earlier this month by a team of researchers and students as part of a study tracking the sharks' migration in the Gulf. The study of black-tip, bull, black-nose, and tiger sharks tracks where the sharks go in the Gulf and their impact on everything from ecosystems to the economics of Gulf fisheries. Ahead, a conversation with the researchers tagging the sharks and following them as they traverse our coast. Plus, today is Bring Our Daughters to Work Day, so we thought we'd have a look at the female entrepreneurs of Southwest Florida. Our state is among the top in the nation in the number of women-owned businesses, and two women will be inducted into the Lee County Business Hall of Fame next week. We'll talk with those women and about an upcoming event for women interested in taking that leap to entrepreneurship. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Women in the workplace no longer means support staff. Florida ranks fifth in the nation for the number of women-owned businesses, and that number is growing. But what challenges do women face, and how hard is it to make that leap to self-employment? We'll talk with two award-winning female entrepreneurs about the risks and benefits. We'll also learn more about an upcoming small business development event focused on women entrepreneurs. But first, in just 1 5-day trip along the Gulf Coast of Florida, researchers from Moat Marine Lab and the New College of Florida were able to perform multiple studies of several species of shark that call the Gulf of Mexico home. Along with their students, the researchers also tagged some of the sharks with satellite trackers, watching them make their way through the Gulf and learning more about the role sharks play in the ecosystems along our coast. Joining us now to talk about the study and what they hope to learn from watching these sharks swim is Dr. Robert Huter. He's the director of the Center for Shark Research at Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium in Sarasota. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Also joining us today is Dr. Jane Gardner. She's a biology professor with the New College of Florida who brought along her graduate and undergraduate students to help tag the sharks. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
We are talking to researchers about the sharks in the waters along the Gulf Coast. Call in to share your fish stories or ask your questions to our shark experts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. First, Dr. Jane Gardner, with the New College of Florida, you said that this 5-day trip in the Gulf supported a lot of different research projects. So what were your big goals for this trip?
So our primary goal was really education for the students, while also simultaneously surveying the populations of large coastal sharks in our area. And we had 40 different undergraduate students that came in the field with us between New College and our partners at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg. And this was just really an incredible opportunity for them. Many students at that sort of stage in their career don't get these kinds of opportunities. So it was a really fantastic hands-on learning experience for them. In addition to that, we had graduate students, one from the University of North Florida and one from the University of Florida, who were able to collect really critical data for their projects as well. We also had a scientist from the Nature Conservancy who was deploying satellite tags on some specific large shark species. And then I was able to get some fin clips as well for some of my colleagues who are conducting genetic analyses to try to understand stock structure for these various shark species in the Gulf of Mexico.
So they talk about hitting a lot of birds with one stone, but it seems like you guys hit a lot of sharks and a lot of studies with one boat.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was really just a fantastic group effort. Everybody really worked together to make this happen, and I really have to acknowledge my colleagues, Dr. Huter at Moat and Dr. Bill Zolostowski at Eckerd, for their participation, as well as Dr. Jorge Brenner, who brought the satellite tags, Kristen Wilkinson from the University of Florida, and Sam Annert from the University of North Florida. And, just the fantastic effort of the support staff as well, Jack Morris, who kept all of the gear going and kept everybody safe on board, and the support staff back at New College who facilitated all of this, because normally to go out on the Bellows, which is the research vessel from the Florida Institute of Oceanography, you would be limited to about 8 to 10 people who stay on board on an overnight trip. And so we operated sort of a shuttle service that allowed us to move this number of people back and forth, and that really took a tremendous effort on their part, coming out very early in the morning and staying very late at night to kind of move people back and forth and make sure that everybody got to do their part. So I'd really like to thank all of them as well for their hard work on this.
Kind of like some water choreography. That's kind of like tag team researching.
Absolutely.
So Dr. Robert Huter with the Moat Marine Lab, you're in charge of the Shark Research Center there at Moat. What was your goal with this research?
Well, first of all, I just want to mention I did not hear any of Dr. Gardner's audio on my line, so I don't know what she said, but I'm sure she covered the scope of what we were trying to do. And basically, this unique trip last week, unique in the sense that it was together with New College of Florida and with Eckerd College in St. Pete, was designed to build on studies that we've been doing here since the early 90s, looking at the relative abundance, what we call the relative abundance, or the numbers of sharks that are out there in Southwest Florida. And I would say, I mean, what the upshot of the big picture of what we did last week was that we had such a nice diversity of sharks caught, 6 different species and 54 different animals, that it was kind of uplifting for an old guy like me who's been working on sharks since the 1970s, and especially the last 25 years dealing with nothing but declines and depletions, to see some nice evidence along with other studies that are being done around the U.S. East Coast to indicate that sharks are coming back. So this was a great research opportunity to add to our knowledge, add to our database on relative abundance of sharks, and it was even better educational opportunity for the students that we had on board.
So you said, you indicated that you've got a database there that's going back 25 years. You've been studying these sharks for the last 25 years. How often do you get to go out and kind of, you know, I don't want to say take the temperature, but how long do you get to go out and kind of see what's out there?
That's actually a great way of putting it, that taking the temperature of the population. We used to do this about 4 times a year, sometimes even more often back up through around 2010, but funding for this kind of work really dried up after about 2010. So it's these kinds of studies, unfortunately, are not done as often as we'd like, but we were really happy to get this done last week.
So what have you seen the sharks go through in the last 25 years? What kind of issues have they faced and that you're happy to see that they've overcome?
Well, beginning in the late 1970s, we started to see the beginnings of some declines in the numbers of sharks. If you go back to 1955, when Dr. Eugenia Clark started Moat Marine Laboratory, she could catch sharks anytime she wanted, basically. If she put out 10 hooks, she'd get 7 or 8 sharks on 10 hooks. And beginning in the late 1970s, fisheries targeting sharks began to increase in number. First, the recreational fishery, and then later the commercial fisheries targeting sharks. And in by the mid-80s to late 80s, shark populations were beginning to show severe signs of depletion, even collapse in many areas around the U.S. East Coast and other places around the world. So since then, we have been kind of doing the science of decline, science of depletion, which has been kind of depressing in some ways, but has meant that a lot of work needed to be done to inform the public and policy managers how we can rebuild these populations. And here we are now 25 years later, and we're seeing signs of the sharks coming back. So that's a pretty cool thing, and it's finally a good story in terms of the health of the oceans.
Yeah, you don't get a lot of those. So what do you think you would credit with that kind of a comeback? What kind of regulations do you think have helped?
Well, we've had fisheries management for shark fisheries in Florida since 1992 and on the federal level since 93. So basically 25 years of incremental management measures to restrict the commercial fishery and the recreational fishery down to what's sustainable. And it has taken 25 years because these animals have such a slow and long life history, what we call life history, in other words, the time they take to grow up to maturity and the number of young that they produce, that you can't just rebound the population in a matter of a couple of years. And after 25 years of restrictions, protection of certain species, and working with other countries to develop conservation plans on animals that go back and forth between jurisdictions, we're finally, I think, seeing the payoff and seeing some of these animals return.
Yeah. And I want to switch back to Dr. Jane Gardiner with the New College of Florida. You said that you wanted to learn about how and why sharks locate certain habitats, like nurseries. Do you have any hypothesis on how they select the areas from among countless miles along the Gulf Coast?
Yeah, so it's really not my theory as to how this is happening. This is sort of research that's been ongoing from a number of folks over the past many years, trying to understand why we do see these young animals in the same areas sort of year after year. And it's this notion that these areas are to some degree safe from predators. So they tend to be areas where it's a little bit more difficult for the larger sharks to get into, because larger sharks will eat small juvenile sharks. And so the areas that are particularly productive, where the juveniles are successful and they go on to become adults that are later reproducing, that it's sort of advantageous to them if they return to the areas where they were born when they're ready to give birth to pups of their own.
So they kind of learn from what their parents did.
Right, or they're imprinting perhaps to the area where they're born, and they remember sensory signals that would and cues that would allow them to find their way back when they're ready to reproduce.
So are you trying to figure out how it is that they have that imprint happen?
Ultimately, that's the goal, yes.
That's pretty intriguing. I mean, it's a lot of years. In between, how many years between the time that they're born and they come back?
Well, it's going to depend on the shark species. So for my primary study species, the black-tipped shark, which is one of our major shark species that's of both commercial and recreational importance in the Gulf, that time frame isn't terribly long. So females are sexually mature at about 5 to 6 years of age. But for other species that have a really long time to maturity, which is, of course, part of what contributes to these animals being particularly vulnerable to overfishing, you could be waiting a really long time to see whether these animals that were born there, if you tag them, for example, to see whether or not they're coming back to the same areas. And so there have been a few studies that have been able to do this kind of thing, and it does take a lot of hard work over a large number of years in many cases to really kind of answer those questions.
So we're talking about sharks in the Gulf, and we'd like to know what your thoughts are. What questions do you have? Call in and ask our experts today on Gulf Coast Live at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So I'm going to stick with you, Jane Gardiner. We've seen some of the incredible photos of the researchers and students with their hands on the sharks just inches away from mouths that are filled with teeth that are sharp. They are not dull. Is it dangerous to get that close and hands-on with sharks like that?
Well, it can be. I would certainly say if you were handling one alone, it might be a little bit of a risky venture. But when you have a good team working with you and everybody's doing their part to ensure that the animal is not able to sort of turn and bite somebody, it's not really that much of a risky activity. And actually, a lot of times we tell the students that the tail is actually the more dangerous end of the animal. People worry more about the head and about the teeth, but they have very powerful, very muscular tails as well. And, of course, their skin is very rough. It's very much like sandpaper. And so if you were to kind of get hit with this really powerful tail that's sort of covered in sandpaper, that's not a great thing either.
That could give you kind of like a road rash kind of experience.
That's exactly what it is. We call it shark burn.
Oh.
But that's what you get from them if you kind of get hit with the tail on the arm or the leg or something like that. Not a, you know, fatal wound to you or anything like that, but certainly something that's very uncomfortable. But with a very large and powerful tail, a large animal could actually give somebody a pretty good hit. And so we're very careful when we bring an animal on board that we have control of the animal at all times. So we'll use things like scooping them up in a very large, what we call a catch-up net, that can contain even a very large animal to help bring it on board safely. We maintain control of the mouth by holding on to the line that it's hooked with. And often we'll put a tail rope on the animal as well to kind of keep control of that end as we bring them on board. And once they're on the deck, we kind of have everybody involved in kind of maintaining control of different areas of the body of the animal. And we do things like putting a hose that's pumping seawater into the mouth of the animal. That tends to help them relax a little because, of course, they can't breathe when they're up in the air. They need to be in the water to breathe. And so by introducing the water into the mouth and it flows out over the gills, we're helping breathe for them while they're up out of the water, which tends to calm them. And we cover the eyes as well with a damp cloth. And that's also something that helps the animal to relax.
Makes them a little bit less disoriented and freaked out. And, you know, I wondered about that when I looked at the pictures because I'd see that hose going in their mouth. I was like, what is that about? I couldn't figure it out. But thank you for explaining that to me. Now, is there a difference between the different species and how they behave? Because, you know, you always hear around the Gulf Coast that, bull sharks and tiger sharks are a lot stronger and a lot more resistant to when they're caught. Is that true or not?
There's certainly a notion that some species fare a little bit better when they've been caught on fishing gear than others, and there's ongoing work in that area to try to understand what happens with these animals when they're exposed to various types of stress. And so people are looking at things like levels of blood hormones and things like that in response to animals being caught on recreational or commercial gear. Most of them do fairly well, provided that you're able to do this kind of work quickly. And so it's essential to have a good team like we did that can really work an animal up quickly and get them back in the water successfully.
How quick of a turnaround do you have? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but how quickly can you get them out and get them tagged and get them back in?
Very quickly, within a matter of minutes.
Oh, that's pretty fast. So, Dr.
Five. It's sort of our usual aim point is to have them on the deck for five or less.
Five or less?
Yeah.
So Dr. Robert Huter with Moat Marine Labs, in the end, you guys caught more than 50 sharks and you tagged more than 30 of them. How did you decide which sharks to tag and which ones not to?
Well, it depends on what questions we're asking. We had someone on board from the Nature Conservancy who's interested in across Gulf movements of the larger predatory sharks. And in this case, we had a couple of satellite tags. He brought a couple of satellite tags to tag a tiger shark and a bull shark, so we got those out. You know, all of the larger sharks in good condition were tagged with at least a plastic tag that identifies that individual shark should it be recaught. And we have a student, and again, I couldn't hear Dr. Gardner's audio, so excuse me if I'm repeating, but we had a student from the University of Florida, Kristen Wilkinson, who's doing her PhD on the interactions between bull sharks and dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, and so she put what are called acoustic tags in each of the bull sharks that we were able to tag. So we're addressing a lot of different questions, and Jane may have also explained that in addition to the tagging, we also took blood and a host of other kinds of samples while we had the animals on deck for 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a quick turnaround, so it has to be very organized. So tell me about some of the sharks. You had one juvenile male tiger shark called the Judge who was tagged during that study. So what's he been doing ever since you tagged him in mid-April?
So tiger sharks are really cool because they seem to wander quite a bit. So it's a little hard to figure out their patterns, but with more data, these things start to come into view. And it looks like the females, in general, in sharks, have more of a sort of a cycle, whereas the males are just these wandering rogues that find the females when they have to. And that's a generalization. And, of course, there's 500 different species of sharks, and they all do things differently. But the tigers are really they really roam around the open sea quite a bit, and then come into the coast as these did. And so the Judge took off after we tagged him, and he's been 70, 80 miles offshore. His tag will last, his satellite tag will last, we hope, at least a year. And very probably we'll see movements across the Gulf of Mexico, probably even out of the Gulf and perhaps to as far as South America. We'll see in the coming year.
So how long does, you said it lasts a year as a tag, does the tag kind of fall off or what happens to it?
Yeah, the tag is attached to the fin, and the fin is sort of inert. They don't really have any real feeling.
Kind of like piercing our ears.
Yeah, exactly. And the tag is is attached with some hardware that will eventually rust through, and then the whole thing will drop off after the tag has served out its useful life.
So since I'm heavy on the phone, and I've always been curious about this, can you tell me a little bit about the interactions between dolphins and sharks? Do sharks eat dolphins, and are dolphins able to turn the tables on sharks?
Sure. I mean, this is the fine aspects of this are exactly what Kristen Wilkinson is studying for her PhD at the University of Florida, but in residence here at Moat. You know, it's an old myth. People used to say, well, if you see dolphins in the water, then it's safe. There's no sharks around. Well, that's just not the case. I've seen tons of examples out in the sea where we have lots and lots of dolphins around, and we see lots of sharks. So they coexist. The dolphins certainly don't, as far as we know, don't feed on the sharks at any size, but the sharks definitely harass the dolphins, and they like to... They go after the young dolphins, in particular the sick animals. Dr. Randy Wells, who has run the dolphin research program here in Sarasota for decades, has documented the presence of scars of shark bites, which we think are primarily bull sharks, on a large proportion of the dolphins in this area. I can't remember the exact number, but I know it's at least 30%. So this is something that dolphins deal with all the time. It's at the very least a nuisance, and at the worst, it's a source of mortality for them. And the specific interactions, the behavioral interactions, and how dolphins deal with this are the subject of Kristen Wilkinson's PhD.
Yeah, it's interesting because you hear wives' tales about all of these animals people that don't study them for a living, we hear things and we kind of believe, oh, yeah, well, dolphins can turn around and they can chase off a shark. Have you ever seen any of that?
Yeah, they can. And there are documented examples of dolphins defending themselves and defending their young against sharks in the area. And actually, it's kind of interesting during right after World War II, and actually when I was kind of getting into the field in the mid-70s, the Office of Naval Research was doing some work to train dolphins to attack sharks so that they could take out these trained animals and possibly use them to fend off sharks for their divers. It turned out that really wasn't necessary, and it wasn't the risk of the sharks wasn't that great, so they eventually abandoned the program, but the dolphins were trainable, and they would go after the poor sharks in that program, and were pretty effective at driving them away.
Oh, well, so you've been studying sharks for a while. Obviously, it must be something that you like. Have you just always been drawn to wanting to learn more about the shark?
No, I actually hated it. I'm just miserable in my job of 40 years. I've just stayed here.
So you've just always been drawn to these guys. They're so powerful and strong. But, I mean, a lot of people just consider them scary.
You know, I was kidding because people say, oh, you must like it if you've been studying them for more than 40 years. I say, I hope so because it's you know, I could have done something else. But they're such fascinating animals. I learn something new every single day. That's why I'm in science. That's why I'm in this field, is to learn and to transmit that learning onto next generation and onto others. With all that we've learned about sharks over the last, especially the last 25 years, we still have a long way to go. The technologies that are coming out now to help us are opening up whole new worlds of being able to study these animals. So it's a very exciting time. It's been an exciting career for me. It's going to be exciting for the next generation with the tools that they have. And that was what the trip last week was all about, was demonstrating to the young students what the potential is.
Do you think that people need to be afraid of sharks, or do you think they're unreasonable in their fear?
Well, I think people need to respect the animals, and that respect goes across the full spectrum from being wary of them and not doing the wrong thing when you're in the water if sharks are there. And it also, the respect goes to the opposite end, which is to understand that their benefit as an ecological resource, not only to us but to the ocean as a whole, is much outweighs any kind of any kind of threat they have to us. You know, the number of shark incidents involving people is generally less than about 100 a year. Fatalities are less than about 10 a year, and this is around the entire world with all the people in the water, you know, every year, all the sharks that are there. So, yes, it happens, and when a shark bite or an all-out attack happens, it's significant and serious. But as a threat, as a kind of a danger to people, there are many more things that statistically are much more dangerous than being bitten by a shark.
And they are more endangered by our activities, obviously, as you mentioned, with their declining populations in the past and fortunately rebounding. But you said that, you know, there are a lot of things that people do that that harms the shark populations. What sharks are there that are able to be fished? Are there any?
I'm glad you asked that, because that's important. You know, we can't treat these animals as if they're all endangered species, and every single animal is so critical that if one dies, for example, in our care, that's just a tragedy. We're not at that point. We're dealing with 500 different species, and some of them are quite resilient and are sustainable to fishing pressure. One is a shark that we caught the most of last week, and that's the black-tip shark here in the southeast U.S., also found in many other areas around the world in subtropical areas and warm temperate areas. This is a faster-growing species. They don't get to be huge, maybe 7 feet or so, and they have a decent number of young in pretty quick fashion that they can sustain fishing pressure. And they are a species that's actually very healthy right now. They're rebuilt, and they're sustainably fished by our U.S. commercial and recreational fishermen. And we have some other smaller species, what we call small coastal species, like the sharp-nosed shark and the bonnethead, which we see in places like Mexico, are also being sustainably fished. That is, the fishery, the population is staying level with fishing.
That bonnethead looks like a miniature hammerhead, doesn't he?
A little hammerhead, and it's fairly prolific and, again, fast-growing. So the point is that there's nothing wrong with shark fishing. There's not even, in my opinion, anything wrong with shark fin soup, if that's how you want to use the sharks. The problem is we have to not kill too many of them, and we have to make the fishery sustainable.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you both for talking with us today about this recent research trip, and look forward to hearing what is gleaned from that activity. Dr. Jane Gardner with the New College of Florida, thank you for joining us. Also want to thank Dr. Robert Huter with the Moat Marine Lab. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, women-owned businesses are among the fastest-growing sector in new business in Florida. We'll talk about what's driving women to start their own businesses, what challenges they face, and what support is out there for them. That conversation is next.